Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. Oh, yeah. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at Critically Acclaimed.
Is this We've Got Mail After Dark?
Yeah, my name is William DeBiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. Welcome to Critically Acclaimed Nights.
Oh, God, we're going to... Do one season doing stupid crime fighting, and then the next season doing stupid monster hunting. This is the podcast here at the Critically Acclaimed channel where we read your emails and we answer your questions and respond to your criticisms and your ideas. And basically, we yield the floor as much as we can. We don't have time to read every email, but we do our best and we want to have a good conversation about the ones that we do read. So if you want to join in, the email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. There's not much more to it than that, really. So let's just, away we go. Let's not dilly-dally. We missed last week because I got sick. We had a lot of catching up to do.
So I'm glad you're better. Here we are with your letters.
Trying.
Here's a letter from James.
Yeah.
Bibbs and Whitney, I fixed Star Trek.
Ooh.
Oh, thank goodness.
Didn't know it was broken. Actually,
yeah,
I did, actually.
CBS All Access is no more. Not the shows, but the J.J. Abrams movie from 2009.
Oh.
Although it was highly acclaimed when it was first released, and sentiment for most moviegoers was at least pretty positive, it seems from my perspective that reception to it has cooled over the years. I rewatched it a year ago, and once again recently I've determined the problem.
Hmm.
I am not at all a Trek follower. I don't know the proper terms these days. Just say Trekkie. It's
Trekkie
fine.
Is fine.
But during the initial rewatch, I came away with a simple conclusion. The opening act of the 2009 Star Trek film is quite possibly the most useless 28 minutes of cinema that has ever been filmed. No meaningful character arcs are set up, and no necessary plot detail is brought up here that isn't brought up again later. Because of that, you don't even know why you're watching the movie until more than 40 minutes in when they get the distress signal. My solution? Off with its head. Or feet. I had the idea. What if you just watch the film starting at the 28-minute mark?
Mm.
Right after the last of what felt like a jillion flashbacks. And you know what? It slaps. Start the movie when Nero is first introduced right after the 3 years later text. The intro with Nero functions as a cool teaser, and then you transition right to Kirk telling Bones that he's going to beat the Kobayashi exam, and that whole scene quickly sets up the character conflict between Kirk and Spock, setting up the potential growth before inciting action interrupts the scene and gets to the movie in full swing. And Whitney will like this detail. From that point to when the credits start to roll, it's an easy breezy 90 minutes.
Nice. Well, I do appreciate that.
I wish more filmmakers would eschew the impulse to give us 100% context for everything we see. Oh, God, do I agree with that.
Oh, yeah, Luca is opposed as well.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey, Luca.
Kitty noises back there.
You want to join in the podcast?
One bit in that opening 28 minutes explains why Uhura holds a grudge against Kirk, but then I watched it without the context, and it made the world feel more lived in, like these characters did in fact exist on their own and live their own lives outside the confines of the film's runtime.
Yeah.
I could tell that she was prickly towards him. But it didn't matter why. Anyway, I'm sure both of you, being so well-read on Star Trek, will have a thousand reasons why this movie still sucks regardless, and that's why we love you, but I think it functions a hell of a lot better than the original cut, and is a good case study on the bloat of action blockbuster cinema. I wish someone up the chain at Paramount had the guts to take that screenplay and rip the first 30 pages off before giving it back to J.J. Abrams to shoot. Very quickly, I wonder if you can think of other examples of films where you can just lop off the beginning, the middle, or end bits without losing anything and producing a better result. Thank you as always, James.
James, thank you so much for listening in. I will say this, if you are a Trek person, the opening is at least, some of it is needed to establish that this is a new timeline, which is why it's not following the original story that people know.
Yeah.
But beyond that, yeah, there's a lot of bloat there. But, there's a lot you don't need in that.
But here's another question. Do you need to establish that it's a new timeline, or can you just have another timeline?
Also fair.
Yeah.
I think what they wanted to have it be new, but also respect the old canon and not pretend it didn't exist, which I think was kind of a mission statement. And I think they found a pretty decent way to accomplish that goal, but does it muddy the start of the movie and make it weird for people who don't understand or care about previous canon? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah.
This is something Scott Mendelson pointed out. The 2009 Star Trek was really well regarded.
Yeah.
And it was nominated for
the Producers Guild. It was almost, people thought it was going to be nominated for Best Picture for a while because it got a PGA nomination.
Yeah, it was a big deal at the time. It was really highly acclaimed. A lot of, you know, sort of old stick-in-the-mud Trekkies like me are saying, well, this isn't in the spirit of Star Trek at all. This is like an action picture. This is more like Star Wars than Star Trek.
It's more like Wrath of Khan. Come on. Star Trek always had one toe in
it, that. I suppose so, but this is like the first just like gigantic action picture.
Yeah.
And Scott Mendelson pointed out, well, this Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness were made at a time when there weren't Star Wars movies around. Like something needed to fill that gap. And Star Trek sort of rushed in and said, we can be kind of like Star Wars too. We can have a lot more weapons and a lot more action.
Especially
and shooting and
Abrams,
stuff.
Abrams, who openly admitted in interviews that he was more of a Star Wars guy. But you know what? Like there weren't any Star Wars to be made. Yeah. So he turned Star Trek into Star Wars.
Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, whatever you think of the movies, were hits. Many, many people went to go see them.
Yeah.
And Star Trek Beyond, the film that followed, wasn't as big a hit. And you'll notice that Star Trek Beyond came after they started making Star Wars movies again. The idea being that we didn't need Star Trek to fill Star Wars' place anymore once Star Wars came back.
I think I'm sure that's probably a part of it, like the space opera itch was being scratched. But I also think it's worth noting that sometimes unpopular movies are successful at the box office because people buy their tickets before they know if it's good or not.
Yeah.
And in the case of Star Trek Into Darkness, there definitely are a lot of people who are dissatisfied with that movie, you and me included. Mm. And
we did a whole commentary track about it.
And I suspect that the lack of success of Star Trek Beyond also has at least something to do with people feeling burned by the last one. So the new one, even if it's better, is not going to be as appealing because last time they set us up for something really, really huge and it was really predictable and it didn't really satisfy.
There are many reasons why Star Trek Beyond didn't take off.
Yeah.
But yeah, to address the larger issue at hand, though, the idea of modern blockbusters being overwritten is definitely a problem.
Sure.
that I've noticed for quite some time, because there was a time when you could get away with telling somebody's backstory with a few sentences or having a couple lines of dialogue, and there wouldn't necessarily even be a flashback.
Yeah. Look at Tim Burton's Batman. His whole backstory is in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Like they make you think you're going to see Batman's origin, but it's just a mugging that's just a little similar. But they actually it's just who is it? Is it Robert Wall plays the reporter?
Yeah,
Robert Wall shows in as like Vicky. Vicky, I think your new boyfriend's kind of messed up, and he tells her about what happened to his parents. That's how you get Batman's backstory. That's it.
Well, she follows him to like a bad neighborhood, and he puts two roses on the sidewalk and walks away. And we don't know what that is.
It's like a 15-second scene. You don't need anything more than that. Yeah. Batman's origin is incredibly simple.
You look at Batman Begin. Well, that's a whole origin story, but there's a huge amount of time devoted to all of that. Mm-hmm. And the one that really got under my skin was Frozen, where we see them as kids and they sing songs and we learn about how she had powers as a child and they had to go to these trolls and get her memory erased and then the parents die and then they're adults. And okay, you could have started there, right? You didn't need any of that stuff with them as kids.
You can do look at how Beauty and the Beast opens with like the storybook.
Yeah,
gives you a quick backstory, little bit, boom, you're out of here.
Yeah. I feel like in a modern version of Beauty and the Beast, which we had, they would dramatize all of that, which they did.
They did. They had like, did you know that the prince was having like weird masquerade orgies the whole time? And that's when like this old witch showed up and he was like, no, we don't want any old witches at our masquerade orgy.
No.
And I'm like, Bill Condon, how Candyman are you going to make this? And turns out not a lot.
There's two
Bill Condons, aren't there?
But then Frozen continues apace, and it's like the coronation. The woman's going to become queen, but then she has this outburst of frozen energy. Meanwhile, there's the other sister is starting an affair with this other guy, and then she reveals her powers, runs off to the hills, and then I think the movie starts. It's like we're halfway done now. It's like, shouldn't we? Maybe we should start with Anna, unprepared, going into the snowy castle looking for a sister we haven't seen yet.
Well, that's one way to do it.
But that's the story, isn't it? It's about the sisters reconnecting. All that other stuff is completely extraneous.
I'm going to fight you on that. And here's why. Because it's not Anna's story. It's Anna and Elsa's story. And if you're only seeing it from Anna's perspective, that's the how the story begins. But if you're seeing it from both, then you need to see Elsa fleeing, having just exposed herself and basically outed herself to the whole world. So we get that whole subplot. Yeah. That's the theme of the movie right there, that we're losing in order to focus on the simplified plot. And I think that's something that is a risk. When you try to reduce a movie to its simplest components, I'm trying to shorten as much as you can.
You get a more efficient movie.
You get a more efficient movie. Hey, no nips. What are you doing, buddy? He's nipping me.
The cat is rambunctious tonight.
But you get an efficient movie, but efficient isn't necessarily the purpose of all cinema, is it? Hell, you love Love Diaz. It's not about efficiency. It's about experience. It's about theme. There's a million other things you're trying to accomplish.
That's not the type of filmmaking I'm talking about.
I think you're giving the short shrift to entertaining filmmaking as though the purpose of these movies is merely to present to you a sequence of events, and that's not strictly true. I think there's also a matter of sort of enjoying the world, living in it, like actually getting to know the characters, and actually using the entertaining stories to try to evoke something that actually has some value, as opposed to merely being escapist entertainment. And I'm not saying that both approaches can't work, but what I'm saying is that to say that only one of those approaches has value is unfair. That being said, what I think is happening
what I'm saying is that by adding all of that extra stuff, you're making the film a lot worse.
Well, hey, what is with you, Luca?
Is Luca hungry? What's going on here?
He keeps nipping at my cat.
You have to hold him.
I'm going to hold you, buddy. Luca,
what do you think? Do you think movies are overwritten?
Yes, I think they're overwritten.
I think they're overwritten. No, I was going to give you an example of the example I was thinking of was actually Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Okay.
Which got, let's be fair here, pretty goddamn butchered by the studio, didn't it? Like, it really got, not only did it get chopped up, but it got rewritten and rescored, and it's a very different movie. The basic sequence of events is functionally the same, but it's a very different feeling film. Seeing Zack Snyder's full-length, like, four-hour cut of that thing makes me think two things. One, wow, there really was a better cut of that movie. And two, there's also a better cut of this movie, because the first half of Zack Snyder's Justice League doesn't need to be that long. It really doesn't.
Yeah.
You do not need... Every scene plays out as long as it could possibly be. There's no efficiency within the scenes. Sometimes we want efficiency within the whole movie, but there's also just something to be said for this scene only exists to convey this much.
Right.
And letting it play out because you like all the dialogue or because you just... You write a screenplay, and the screenplay can be as long as it needs to be, and you film it thinking you're going to need all this material, and then you watch the material and you say to yourself, that scene is redundant, that information is conveyed visually earlier in the movie, we no longer need that scene. That scene, I like that scene, but that scene is holding us back now because it's not contributing anything.
Right.
And that's the second half of Justice League, pretty solid. First half of Zack Snyder's Justice League, lot of padding.
Yeah.
Lot of padding. That is a like 2 hour and 30, maybe 45 minute superhero epic that you could cut an hour and like you cut an hour to get that.
Yeah.
The 4 hour one, too damn long. Doesn't need to be that long. Feel better than the theatrical though.
What are some other movies? I feel the same way about Thor Ragnarok is a film that I think is a good movie stuffed into the middle of a different movie. All of the stuff at the beginning that like links it up, and Doctor Strange is in it, and they're trying to set it in the real world, and we learn about sort of the fall of Asgard, and we get to see Kate Blanchett show up. Cut all of that, every bit of it, and
that's one of those ones where because all the stuff on like what's the name of the Hulk world that they're on.
Whatever the name of the garbage world is, you start the movie with Thor falling out of the sky on a weird garbage world.
I love that.
Out of your element, it's kind of comedic, and it's kind of a mystery. We actually, he can give us information as we go.
Yeah.
And we can have like an actual visual flashback because you want to have Kate Blanchett vamping it up in that antler outfit.
I mean, it's cool. I feel like that's just one where it's almost like Star Trek 2009 again, where there's something you need to convey just to wrap some shit up, because Thor Ragnarok is the third Thor movie and it's got other films in the series as well. And there's stuff
that's to its detriment.
I agree. And I think on everything before Thor gets like stuck in Gladiator world, what the fuck is that planet called? Don't text me. I'll look it up later.
The Klingon homeworld, whatever it's called.
That's it.
It's Kronos.
Kronos. with a Q. No. It's all that stuff at the beginning is basically the last Thor movie that people saw. It was a big blockbuster.
Hmm.
Ended with a lot of loose ends that Taika Waititi has to wrap up so he can tell the story he wants to tell.
Hmm.
And maybe there was a faster way to do it, but he gets it done, and then the good movie can begin.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you play the cards you're dealt, and you're forced to deal with. Again, these are people who work for hire. They're told to wrap things up. They have to do the job.
I understand that, but those are all studio decisions. They're not creative decisions, and they're not put in there to make the movie better. In fact, they're kind of bogging the movie down.
Yeah.
I understand a lot of people, when they go to see a gigantic blockbuster, want their money's worth, and they're not going to want to be out on the street again in 80 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mind if it's good. I don't care. But, heck, go back in. See it again. We used to do that. We used to watch a movie, and if we liked it, we'd go back and see it a second time. I feel like there are far more entertaining and intriguing and creative ways to tell these stories without literally showing us everything.
Yeah.
Show us less. We don't need to see it all. It can be conveyed in dialogue. It can be conveyed in flashbacks. It can be conveyed in a look.
Again, I think
we don't need everything so explicitly depicted. And if you want to have so much of this in the runtime, it's just making the movie longer, not richer.
If you want to get a sense of how to tell these stories really efficiently and satisfactorily, I recommend watching genre films from the 1930s, especially horror movies. They get so much movie out of Frankenstein. And the original Frankenstein's like, what, 71, 72 minutes?
Yeah, it's pretty short.
It doesn't feel short. It feels like they told the complete story. Everything took as long as it needed to. Mm. They didn't pad the running time to make the audience feel like they got their money's worth. The audience was incredibly happy with what they got. That said, long movies can be fun too. Don't get me wrong, but I feel like a lot of it boils down to is a lot of people are writing as much as they possibly. Patton Oswalt had a good bit about this, where he talked about how movies are often directed by men and they're just trying to show off how much footage they can produce, and many of the best movies ever made were edited by women who were basically just saying okay, you go run off and play. I'm going to go find a way to make this work by cutting out half of it.
He compared it to fathering a child.
Yeah.
to put it gently.
Yeah.
He's like,
and just going to do their business. And
they're
like,
just going to do their business and think it's all so important. And then the woman says, okay, now I have to make something out of all of this.
All this crap you did. Yeah. It's frankly, it's not his best bit.
It's crass, but I think it's apt.
Yeah. But that's right. People, they write too much. They shoot too much, and that's why you're supposed to edit it down and not release the work print as a movie.
Yeah,
Zach.
And because of the Snyder Cut, and because people are just discovering the notion of the work print.
Yeah,
I've seen headlines in trade papers, prestigious outlets,
The original cut of Black Panther was 4 hours, and I'm like. No, the work print was 4 hours.
You shot everything.
Yeah.
You cut it all together before you start editing. That was never intended to be the movie.
Yeah. It's very, very rare that a movie's supposed to be that long. And if you are making a movie that's that long, you might want to start thinking about reining it the fuck in.
Did you know that David, the statue David, was supposed to be an even bigger block of marble at one point?
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah, it's no, you're supposed to make it. Anyway, let's get on to it.
We're beating a dead horse here. Thank you so much for the letter. That was a good conversation.
Yeah. Here's a letter from Chris from the Netherlands. Hello, Chris from the Netherlands.
Hi, Chris.
Dear W Squared. That's us.
I like that.
I've been wanting to write this email for quite some time now, but I never really felt like I was able to properly word it. As my holiday has officially started, I've decided that I have no more valid excuses, so the procrastination ends now. Disclaimer, there is no question at the end of this email. I've been listening to your podcast for about 5 years now.
Whoa.
Oh my goodness. I am 24 years old. That's 20% of my life.
Wow.
I'm happy to have occupied that space
wild.
With you.
Jeez.
I've always considered your work to be highly informative and enjoyable, but on top of that, your views on life and the manner in which you express them has been a major impact on my life.
That's very kind.
When I first started listening to Critically Acclaimed, I strongly identified with Bibbs. I felt I was a strong ally to the LGBTQ+ community, and I was also in a long-term relationship with an amazing woman, which I still am to this day.
Nice.
However, I was generally not as vocal about my alliance, which I strongly disliked about myself. By not expressing my feelings when the situations occurred when I would have wanted to do so, I felt like I was betraying my true self. Additionally, I also felt like I was betraying my partner, who has always been openly bisexual. Listening to Bibbs expressing himself so eloquently on multiple occasions gave me the confidence and the vernacular to do for myself as well, for which I am very grateful. About a year ago, after a very long period of denial and repressal, I realized I am not actually merely an ally of the LGBTQ+ community, but a member of it myself.
Hey.
My realization hugely influenced my girlfriend's ability to see right through me and actually get me to open up about this part of myself, which is made significantly easier by listening to the both of you. I distinctly remember hearing Whitney's talk about being both a bisexual man and being in a loving relationship for a woman for the first time. Even though I was still in denial when I heard this for the first time, I felt so validated deep inside, and this has always stayed with me. I want to thank you sincerely for being so open about who you are, which in turn has helped me realize who I am. Also, you have played a similar role in me deciding to paint my nails and dye my hair. Oh, thank goodness. Which might be slightly less impactful, but definitely the things I'm super happy about and love to do. My hair is faded to like...
It's actually getting kind of yellow now.
It's blonde now. Yeah, like I bleached it and it was bright blue for a while and it faded and now it's just sort of white blonde.
It still looks pretty cool.
And the last time I painted my nails, it did so much damage I have to wait for them to grow out again a little bit before I can paint them again. But it's almost time.
Yeah.
Hope you both keep doing what you do, provided it keeps making you happy, and I will try to write in again sometime, maybe with an actual question, perhaps a slightly frothier topic. Mm. With the kindest regards, Chris from the Netherlands.
Chris, that's incredibly kind, and thank you. I'm honored, and I don't feel like I deserve that, but that's very, very kind. And you have all our support, and congratulations to you. Yeah, it sounds like you're living a really great life, and that's exciting.
Welcome out. Welcome to yourself.
Yeah.
It's a freeing feeling just to be able to express that. Don't belittle the hair and the nails. It seems like a frivolous thing, but
that's you.
That's how you express yourself outwardly to the public. Yeah. And, there are many, I know some trans people, and there are many trans people who, just being able to wear the clothing they wanted to, just the clothing. It's just fashion, but it's really important because that's the way the world now perceives them. It's how they are seen now.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a big important part of being yourself and being out there. Get the haircut, get your nails painted,
whatever you want.
Yeah, it's never too early and it's never too late to start. So go for it.
Congrats, seriously, and thank you so much for letting us know. And it's an enormous honor. And thank you.
Mm.
Thank you. That's incredibly humbling.
Thank you so much. And thanks for listening. And we hope we can continue to be entertaining and moving and enlightening in ways that you prefer.
Let's move on.
Here's a letter from JP. Hi, JP. And this is a nice frivolous question for us. Dear fellow pognophiles.
Well, I do like pogs.
Pognos. As you are, or at least when I last saw you on the Schmodown, both proud sporters of facial hair, I was wondering if what your favorite movie beard and or movie mustache is.
Okay.
What is your favorite movie beard or movie mustache? JP. That's
ooh,
it.
That's a fun one. That's a big question. I'm actually, I think my favorite mustache lately, at least lately, is Kenneth Branagh in Murder on the Orient Express.
Now both of the mustaches that Kenneth Branagh wears.
It's really quite genius. So the character of Hercule Poirot is very vain, and he's very vain about his mustache. And if you'll recall, Albert Finney in the Sidney Lumet version also sported a glorious mustache. And as he's going to bed on the Orient Express, this train, he's like putting in like a mustache guard, and he's putting the wax on it, and it takes a lot of care to make it just right. When Kenneth Branagh took over the role for Murder on the Orient Express, and he'll do it again in Jewel on the Nile sooner or later, I know it's already shot, he clearly wanted to do the big mustache, but he wanted to do it a different way. And so his solution was to put two mustaches end to end, and they meet under his nose. So he's got two mustaches. It's
that
a
wrap around his entire face.
It's a glorious look. It's a really kudos. Kenneth Branagh is not he's cast himself in a 4-hour Hamlet that cut none of the text out. Mm. You know, he's not...
he's not afraid to point the camera at himself.
Exactly. But he's also apparently not afraid to take the piss out of himself, and good for him. Mm. So that's definitely the first thing that comes to mind lately. I'm also fond of, this is a little bit more obscure, I really love Orson Welles' beard in Mr. Arcadin.
Oh, well,
he's got,
I mean,
this incredible...
Orson Welles wore a beard for most of his life, so, yeah, and it was a large, resplendent thing.
True, but like I think in Mr. Arcadin, it has this very... almost looks like a Greek god. Like, he would have played a great Zeus. well, let me see if I can pick a picture of it, make sure I'm remembering this correctly. Yeah, just this wonderful, glorious, like Falstaff is mad at you kind of beard. And he's just a really good looking a mane on that one. That's another one that comes to mind. What about you? You've been silent.
I'm trying to think of like beards. I just were so really striking. I remember Gerard Butler's beard in 300 was like sculpted. Like they want him to look like a statue. So they kind of like squared it off. That's the way LeBron James wears his beard in the new Space Jam movie.
It's
super squared off.
I hadn't thought of that.
They even make a joke about it when he turns into a cartoon. He has to like twist his hair and his beard back around on his head because they got mixed up. Oh gosh, what I'm trying to think, is there like a living beard of some kind?
I like a living beard. I don't know about that. There's the Tick's mustache in that one episode of.
I appreciate when the actor has clearly grown their own facial hair.
Yeah,
I know that was how they made the movie Cast Away, which is a movie we seem to bring up a lot. Cast Away took a break in the middle of filming because they wanted they wanted Tom Hanks to look like he had been living on that island for like a year or a couple of years.
Yeah, they didn't want to use CGI or put him in like a fat suit in the beginning of the movie. Yeah, they wanted him to actually lose weight, to be the visual effect.
He gained weight for the first half of the movie and then lost a lot of weight over the course. So he got really, really kind of skeletal. And also grew his own beard out. So he actually had a long beard in that movie that was his. And even though the beard is not, fashionable, I appreciate that it's his.
True.
That he had this sort of big wild thing. And can you imagine being Rita Wilson and having to live with?
That's a weird year in their lives. They probably should have written a book about that. Because
I know when Jack Nance was shooting Eraserhead.
It was so
so difficult to get the hair that way, and it took them 5 years to make that movie. Mm-hmm. That he just kept his hair that way for 5 years.
Yeah,
he was just wandering around town, going to donut shops with that thing.
A lot of respect, just in general, to Mr. T. But Mr. T. in Rocky III has an amazing beard. It's like mutton chops that turn into a beard. But then he has like a pencil thin mustache.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a really distinct look, and not a lot of human beings could pull it off. I'm also very fond of Michael Gambon in the Harry Potter movies because he's got this really long beard, but he ties it in a knot in the middle to keep it from like getting all over the place. Which is kind of like, I'm not gonna trim it. All right, I'm not an asshole. But I will tie a little ribbon in it, just to keep it from going everywhere, so it doesn't end up in my soup.
Yeah, I know that we're in a beardy world. You and I have beards. I know razor companies have really been suffering as a result of this.
Beards are popular now.
You'll notice that men's razor companies are saying, "Hey guys, shave your chest."
Yeah.
There's even a whole company called Manscaped.
Their YouTube commercials are so obnoxious.
Yeah, and they're really crass, but they're about shaving your pubic region. And they're like, these razors are specially for that. Well, no, they're not, but they're branding them that way now.
Yeah.
And
like, listen, dudes, we have to come up with a way to convince you to pay us to put a knife to your skin every day.
Also,
and then replace that knife on a regular basis.
Razors are one of the greatest rackets in the world, and in this country.
They
don't need to be as disposable as they are. Nope. They don't need to be as expensive as they are. Nope. It's really, really horrible. And that might have led to the rise of the beard, the hipster beard at first, and now just the beard.
My dad had a beard. I've never saw my dad in person in my entire life without his beard. In fact, only a handful of pictures survive of him without a beard as an adult man. As a little kid, sure. But as an adult man, a couple of pictures of him in the Marines, one when he got back, and then he grew the beard and he never shaved it off. So we never really had that moment where he's like, son, now I'm going to teach you how to shave. Because my dad never shaved. You're not going to teach me how to shave. Well, When's he going to shave it off?
I have a beard, but I shave because I shave my neck and I shave my cheeks. I kind of shape my beard.
Well, yeah, sure. I do a little trimming here and there, but I never really learned how to shave properly, nor was there ever like that ritual of shaving that was included in my house. Because let's be honest here, my dad loved me. The beard was there first. Okay? He's not going to get rid of that for me.
Look, I met the beard first, all right? If the ship is going down, I'm saving the beard.
I think it literally did not occur to him to teach me how to shave. And I think that's really fine. That's fine.
Because he's not shaving. It's like he does.
I'm not offended by it. And it helped make me a beard person because it was never valued. Yeah, you know? It's like beards can be very noble. Feelings can look very, very nice. My dad actually had this whole Sean Connery kind of look. He was very salt and pepper, bald on the top, you know, hair on the sides, nice trim beard. He's a good looking man, actually. Hmm. Yeah. Like if Sean Connery and Bob Hoskins were just put in a blender, then you'd get my dad.
Nice.
Yeah.
My dad was always clean shaven. I think he wanted to teach me how to shave, but I was abroad when I got my first shave. I was a professional. I went to a barbershop. And this was just like getting rid of like the greasy hairs that 15-year-olds get.
You gotta learn how to deal.
Yeah, I just like, what, are you gonna shave that off? No, I don't need to shave. You got these ugly greasy hairs.
You need to shave until they look good. That's the trick. You need to shave a little bit when you first start getting the hair in, so that like they'll come in nice.
And I murdered my face when I first started shaving because not because I cut myself. I was very good about cutting myself. But they always said, oh, you also need aftershave. And I had bad skin. I had pimples. Yeah. So it's like, well, I may as well, you know, I'll shave and I'll also clean my face. So I would just shave and then immediately like rub my face with rubbing alcohol.
Oh, no.
And it was
That's like the most
painful thing. It's like I'm in the bathroom at like 15, 16 years old. You're like, oh, God, why do people do this?
Macaulay Culkin tried to warn you.
He did. And I didn't listen.
Yeah.
Macaulay Culkin were here right now. I'd need an apology.
You
never met me when I had the Kevin Smith goatee, where cheeks and jaws were clean shaven, but I had the mustache and the goatee.
I think you tried that briefly, but then abandoned it once while I knew you, like in like the early 2010s or something. I think you tried that really shortly.
I think I was already clean shaven at that point. But yeah.
I'm just remembering you the way I want to remember you.
Let me remember you in this moment where you look like an extra from a Kevin Smith movie.
Anyway, that's a fun one. Let's move on.
Here's a letter from Zay. Hello, Zay.
Hi, Zay.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I was excited to learn there was going to be an episode of Ghosts of Fear Street, and I had no idea such a thing existed. I grew up in the early 2000s when R.L. Stine's popularity still hadn't died, and he was absolutely my gateway into horror. I still have all of my Goosebumps books, and I hope one day I can bring home a romantic partner who will be very impressed. That's the hope, isn't it?
Yeah. That's why you collect things. You collect things that people will come over and go, ooh, how interesting. I should marry you.
And I was totally that jerk who would like go to a party and like seek out the libraries or the video collections to say, kind of rub my chin. What kind of person is this? Like, I'm judging your character
thing I do when I enter someone's house. If they have a display of their movie collection, which a lot of people I know do because we have similar interests. That's not a requirement. I won't judge you. But if you have it, I'm going to check it out, aren't I? I want to see what's important to you. What movies are important to you to keep on hand? You know, it's like your books or if you're looking in your kitchen. What are your most important appliances? Do you really make that many waffles that you need a waffle iron? Waffle is that important to you, huh? Interesting. Thank you for the tip.
Why do you need 8 food dehydrators?
Because I hate water.
It was a rather sad moment when I saw Scream 4, where the movie-loving character played by Hayden Panettiere, she has her display, like her movie collection, and there's like 15 movies on her shelf. It's like the tiniest little thing.
I know you're of a new generation,
nobody has movies
no.
like that in the same way anymore. It's like, it's accurate, but it's kind of sad.
No, they do. Some people do. Not everyone does, but a lot of people still care, like much like people still, you know, collect vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's becoming a little bit more of like a trendy thing than the norm.
Yeah.
But also a lot of people they don't fetishize the case of their movies and they'll take the disc out and they'll put it in one of those disc sleeves.
Yeah.
Which is a great way to save space if space is at a premium. Mm. I personally like the presentational element and I don't like doing that.
Yeah.
But it makes sense and I'm not going to judge you.
Anyway,
unless it's like a collector's edition case, in which case put that on display.
Like, display.
I have like my branded wooden Wicker Man box set where they actually like had a brand of the Wicker Man and they hand branded the wooden box.
Yeah.
I'm not putting that in a sleeve. I want to show people that. There's only like, they only made like 2,000 of those.
I also have that Predator head box.
Oh,
set.
Yeah.
It's like
that thing's cool.
Sculpted plastic
Predator cool.
head.
That, I always wanted one like that.
It has
like
a removable mask. Yeah. The one that I always... There were a couple I wanted to get. There was the Planet of the Apes set, which had all of the movies to date and all of the TV shows to date.
Yeah.
Like in this big core in a life-size ape head.
Which is pretty cool.
That was pretty cool. And one of the Futurama box sets was a Bender. It's a Bender head, and you can pull it out.
We need to get back to this later.
Anyway, being quasi-expert, I wanted to give some context that wasn't discussed in the episode but was hinted at. Ghosts of Fear Street was actually a book series first that started in 1995. It was in the midst of both Goosebumps and Fear Street at their peak popularity while Stein was actively writing new ones of the original series. Ghosts of Fear Street was basically the Goosebumps equivalent of for Fear Street, in which it was kind of an anthology series, but the characters are all dealing with things on Fear Street. Also, of course,
so it's like
Erie,
Indiana.
Of course, R.L. Stein wasn't writing for another series yet. So this book series was actually all ghost written with Stein's brand on the series title.
Okay, well that makes sense because it's got ghosts in it.
Yeah, this was. this is also a surprising detail I didn't know until very recently. As far as I can tell, this was the only series in which this was the case.
Okay.
Well, I know certain authors do that. They lend their name out to ghostwriters so they can keep their name alive on things, but even after their death, they can keep on writing.
Yeah, look at a lot of books that have James Patterson's name on them were not specifically written by James Patterson.
V.C. Andrews, Tom Clancy,
they play fair usually. They'll actually say on the corner, James Patterson.
Apostrophe
writing, writing with so and so or whatever, like, you know,
blank writing as James Patterson.
Yeah, exactly. Like, which is as long as you're upfront about it, I don't give a shit. It's fair.
Also, another future episode, possibly based on real life Stein's books, was another one season anthology horror show called The Nightmare Room, featuring child actors of the time, Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes, among many others.
We almost did that once. We need to. We might come back to that for Scarytober this year.
Perhaps.
Yeah. It's on the list. We might get to it.
Okay. Here is a letter from...
Oh, thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for writing
in. We did a whole cancel too soon about the failed pilot to Ghosts of Fear Street because the Fear Street movies came out and they're excellent. And it's something that we were excited about and we did some research into, but Fear Street and the other R.L. Stein stuff wasn't quite our generation, so it's nice to hear people talk about it for people who knew it.
You know, I had well-aged out of reading R.L. Stein, but
Like I was on the cusp, but I just
I said, I was already knee-deep in Clive Barker at that point. I'm not going back to R.L. Stein.
Yeah.
Here's a letter from Name Redacted. If you don't sign off, I'm not going to read your name. Hello. I am a basketball and NBA fan.
Ooh.
And this is my Space Jam review.
Okay, nice.
It was terrible. And I hate to pick on the kids, but LeBron's son was so terrible that if he was going to be that bad, I don't understand why they didn't just use his own son, who honestly seems more charismatic. Damian Lillard and Anthony Davis are huge NBA stars. Deanna Taurasi and Nkana I don't know how to pronounce this name. Agognoke?
Okay.
Are not, but they are in the WNBA. I'm not trying to be sexist, but I think I speak for most NBA fans when I say we just don't watch the WNBA. So it's like having stars who you really don't know being put in your movie when they are not in the same caliber of star. I don't know about that.
I understand how that works.
Yeah, I don't follow the NBA or the WNBA, so I don't know
it's
how
the
much
same
like
sport,
like
right?
fandom cross. Well, I know people have their teams and
their
leagues.
Yeah, of course, you'll have their teams, but like,
so yeah, I'm not sure like how much crossover between those particular fandoms.
It's not my world. I never quite understood why there's as much. I understand it at all. Actually, I'm just not going to pretend. All right.
Anyway, I rewatched the first Space Jam, and you are correct about Michael Jordan's acting. It sucks. However, the movie is elevated by the side characters, and they get a lot of the focus and a lot of the lines, and the sheer number of NBA cameos is really awesome for any fan. The first one also has a very consistent Toon World aesthetic, whereas this one has literally no rules. They were not even playing basketball. They could have been playing anything.
Yeah, they're basically playing Calvin Ball. Yeah. Like, the rules don't matter. Yeah.
If you can score 500 points because you manifested 500 coyotes and threw them through the air, then yeah, that's not basketball anymore.
I realize that there are two movies this year that ended in a game of Calvin Ball for the fate of the universe. And one was Space Jam, the other was Psycho Gorman. Psycho Gorman did it much better.
It's a much better movie, Psycho Gorman. They could have been playing anything. Another thing that irked me was when Kronos, the Damon Lillard character, came in. That's the time-controlling robot monster.
Yeah.
They came in and used a rap song. He did, because he is a rapper on the side. If you have to agree about anything about the first one, it's that the soundtrack was iconic and stands the test of time. Mm. And this one had a Damian Lillard song. Sorry for the rant, but this is a missed opportunity that pisses me off more than anything. I give it a 3 out of 10.
Very fair.
Sorry for the long letter. I had to rant to
Space somebody. Jam did have a good soundtrack. I think we can all agree that the soundtrack has like a lot of hit songs on it, and that's not to the movie's credit per se, but whoever produced that soundtrack, you know, put songs on there that people liked. Mm-hmm. Okay. I know there's I think R. Kelly is on there, and that's obviously kind of tainted, but there you go. So that's one element I guess people can get behind.
Here's our next letter.
Thank you for writing in. Again, much like Fear Street, we're not NBA fans, and so like sometimes it's hard to say to ourselves, like, are we just not the target demo for this? Are we missing the point?
Well,
it's good to know that we're not completely out of touch, and that it is possible to enjoy like basketball and not enjoy Space Jam as well. Like, you know, it's not like it's just for that target demo.
I am largely ignorant of the world of basketball. I know who LeBron James is.
Of course.
And what team does he play for? All of them. I know he moves around a lot. I know that's like one of the things he's known for.
I learned that from Space Jam.
Yeah, in fact, there's a joke. Like, did you run out of teams to play for? Bugs Bunny asks him. But, you know, I don't pay attention to statistics. I don't pay attention to, you know, scores. I don't watch games. But this is not something that I want to brag about anymore. Mm. This was something that I was, you know, kind of a jerk about in my 20s. About, oh, I'm not into sports. Sports is dumb. I'm a movie guy. I'm into the arts. And this was true of a lot of movie people. They would brag about how they don't understand games or sports, or they don't want to watch the Super Bowl. That's fine. Don't watch it if you don't want to. But sport fandom is no lesser than any other kind of fandom. And I think people who have a mind for sports and competition are involved in something very exciting. It's not something I'm into, but it's not something that I'm going to be proud of not being into any longer. Really kind of brash about in my 20s.
Yeah, in my teens, I experienced some ostracization because I wasn't into sports, and a lot of the people I went to school with very much were. And I was like, okay, I think I was so used to being sort of frowned upon for not being interested in sports that I developed a bit of an attitude about it. Like, I started being proud that I wasn't into sports. And
well, you turned that into like not liking something is also part of fandom.
But in a specific reaction to specific people around me, that may or may not be forgivable. But as a general tone, it's immature and it's not cool. And I've grown up a lot, and I'm still not super into sports. I'm not. But I respect sports.
I'm into the Olympics. I like that.
I'm not even into the Olympics. I'm like, it's okay. Good for them. I'm glad they're good at stuff. But like, I'm just watching. I'm like, okay, good. Jump higher.
It's exciting. Sports is visceral.
It can be. I'm not necessarily invested in it on a personal level. But I appreciate the achievements.
Unless it's a movie.
Well, in a movie, they tell you what's important, don't they? They tell you, like, what it means to people.
Yeah.
Beyond the abstract. Otherwise, I'm just looking at people, I'm like, ah, I bet they want to win. Mm-hmm. Ah, but I bet that other team does, too. And I'm like, I don't know whose needs are more important.
Yeah.
Like, who's got more invested in this? Because it's not me. I don't know. So, movies, I love sports movies because they guide my affections and my empathy. Actually watching sports, if I followed along and I actually like paid attention and read interviews and like had some dedication to one team or another, I might have that
understood in screenwriting terms the stakes.
Yeah, I might have that, and it might be really, really wonderful, and that could be something really, really powerful. Never really had that. My sports were particularly important to anyone else, my family, so just never had it. Just wasn't prioritized. No disrespect. No, none disrespect whatsoever intended.
I wanted to bring that up before we move on to the next letter.
Yeah, it's just we come from that place when we talk about sports movies. Yeah.
Here's our next letter, also from Name Rejected. They didn't sign it off. Here's a letter. It says, hello there, WNW. That's us. A while back, you were talking about great fake movies you'd love to see, and I asked the listeners for suggestions. To that, I have one sentence to say to you. Hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may remember me from such films as... I'm actor Troy McClure.
Oh my God.
You may remember me from such educational films as Lead Paint, Delicious but Deadly. And Here Comes the Metric System. This is a character joke that just keeps on giving and always puts a smile on my face. Whenever he mentions a film title, I always go, dang it, I want to see that. For anybody who may not be in the know, actor Troy McClure, as voiced by Phil Hartman in The Simpsons, was sort of the go-to pseudo-celebrity, like clearly a celebrity who's fallen on hard times and is now doing an educational video. He was always this fake celebrity who would show up in those educational videos.
He was his name was a portmanteau of Troy Donahue, who was briefly a young, very popular actor when he was young and stuck around and was always in stuff, but his star fell. And also, was it Doug McClure?
Troy McClure.
No. It was a portmanteau of Doug McClure. There's another actor named Doug McClure, right?
I think there is a Doug McClure, yes.
Yeah, so that's what it was. And so every time... Doug McClure. I'm not crazy. He was in The Virginian. Every time he showed up, he would say, like, hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may remember me from such films as... And they always had funny joke names. And in fact, I've got a list online.
Somebody compile all of the films and TV
You may
shows.
Remember me from such films as The Boat Jacking of Super Ship 79. Well, Calling All Quakers.
What was
David versus Super Goliath?
What was the one? It's like Captain Orange and Happy Caramel's Summertime Smile Factory or something along those lines.
Well, there was the one that Troy McClure had like a career boost when he married Marge's sister.
Yeah, eventually turned him into like a character. Like he had episodes about him.
He had a couple episodes, but there was this whole bit where he wanted to play McBain's like sidekick in the new McBain movie, and he had an option of doing that. Or writing and directing his own passion project, The Contrabulous Fabtraption of Professor Horatio Huffnagel, which I like to think was the prequel to The Imaginarium of... not The Imaginarium. What's the...
It is The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
But I was thinking of the Dustin Hoffman movie.
Oh, Mr. McGorry's Wonder Emporium.
Let's see. Say there's some other classic... Anyway,
There's more of the list here, though, so...
Okay.
And indeed, the list you're looking at, I've linked an entire list of movies that he's mentioned throughout the show at the bottom of this mail. This is just a nice way to get a good laugh and open up your imagination. My personal favorites are The Muppets Go Medieval, The Verdict Was Mail Fraud, and Christmas Ape 2, Christmas Ape Goes to Summer Camp.
Forgot about that one. That one's good.
And who can forget his ever-enlightening educational films and self-help systems such as Here Comes the Metric System, Lead Paint, Delicious but Deadly, and Mommy, What's Wrong with That Man's Face? Hope this made you chuck a little. Have an awesome day. Lots of love. Patreon subscriber and longtime listener, Nikolai. Hello, Nikolai.
Hi, Nikolai. Thank you so much. You might remember Nikolai from such films as Good Time Slim, Uncle Doobie, and The Great Frisco Freakout. The Greatest Story Ever Hulud. Hydro, the man with hydraulic arms. Look who's still drinking. Jesus. Dark. The Makeout King of Montana. Preacher with a Shovel. And The President's Neck is Missing.
I like Preacher with a Shovel.
They That's came to burgle.
Gosh, that's funny.
Today we kill, tomorrow we die.
The actual like sex ed video that he hosted that we actually got to see pieces of, it's like, I'm here to talk to you kids about sex in a frank and straightforward manner. So now welcome to Fuzzy Bunny's Guide to You Know What.
Fuzzy Bunny's Guide to You Know What. Also, some of the other educational films he was in, Alice's Adventure Through the Windshield Glass. Alice Doesn't Live Anymore.
Oh, God.
The Decapitation of Larry Leadfoot. Firecrackers, The Silent Killer. The Half-Assed Approach to Foundation Repair. Man versus Nature, The Road to Victory.
I think it'll get much better than Christmas Ape 2, Christmas Ape 2 is the Summer Camp. Oh,
sorry.
It's far, far, far killing too me. Funny. Yeah.
It's killing me. It's killing me. Troy McClure is one of the funniest characters in TV history. Mm. I miss Phil Hartman.
Yeah. He was so great. Just, he was wonderful. Like,
he's one of those actors we never had a replacement for Phil Hartman. Right. There was no one else doing Phil Hartman. We just had him and then he died and it was very sad. It was way too young. It was very tragic. And
he did some very bad movies.
Oh, sure.
He is in Jingle All the Way, which is a terrible
film.
He's funny in Jingle All the Way.
He's nailing it.
He understands that he's playing sort of a broad character, and he decided to actually play that character, and he does it really, really well.
He should have won every Emmy for News Radio.
Yeah.
News Radio was like, you know, back in that must-see TV era, and everyone remembers Friends and Seinfeld and Mad About You, slightly lesser extent, and Will and Grace. Those are like the big four that were like anchored NBC in the 90s. News Radio was on pretty much that whole time as well. News Radio had an incredible cast. Everyone, even Joe Rogan was funny on that show.
Yeah.
Like, everyone had distinct, interesting characters. The first season's a little rocky, but then pretty much every other episode until Phil Hartman passed away, which he did well. Well, he didn't pass away. He was killed. But every episode he was in was genius. And you can look at any Phil Hartman episode, like centric episode of News Radio. Mm. Just look at the episode where he gets a cane. That's the whole episode. He gets a cane, not because he needs it, but because it's an affectation, and it's annoying.
And the Dave Foley character keeps, like, absconding or ruining his canes.
That's the whole episode. There's nothing else going on. He just gets a cane and is a douche about it. And that's it. He made that gold. What a wonderful actor. Wonderful actor.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
R.I.P. Phil Hartman.
Seriously. I think I've time for one more.
Okay. Here is a letter from... let's see here.
You can do it.
Yeah, there's
no name redacted.
Hello, Whitney Seibold and William Bibbiani. I saw the movie Joe Bell. I don't know if you saw it. This is a recent film with Mark Wahlberg.
Okay.
It's the story of Jaden Bell's dad, played by Mark Wahlberg. I'll leave it to you if you want to spoil the plot as to who Jaden Bell is, who has a gay son, played brilliantly by Reed Miller, and who walks across America lecturing people about bullying.
Okay.
The movie is a screenplay
by Larry McMurtry. Mm-hmm. Co-wrote that. No shit. That's
The movie is a bit saccharine and on the nose, but I thought it has its heart in the right place, so I enjoyed it for what it did overall. Its message is essentially, don't treat people like shit because they're different than you, which quite honestly is a lesson many of us learned a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly some people haven't, so we need to keep saying it.
It's one of those things where like you keep repeating it. Like a lot of people are like, I know. A lot of people don't, so we keep saying it.
But yeah, it's a blue-collar guy, has a son he loves very much, and something really horrible happens to his gay son, and he has to sort of start essentially a lecture circuit tour.
Okay.
I was about to write this movie off calling it No Shit, the Movie, but it dawned on me that there are more than enough people on this planet that desperately need to learn this lesson, as obvious as this movie is. I think that Joe Bell would absolutely play to the very people that need to learn the message the movie presents the most. Its preachiness about treating gay people as people didn't come into play until later into the movie, after I suspect that certain people have already sided with Mark Wahlberg's character, Joe Bell. Mm. Unfortunately, I know many a homophobe. I think they would see this movie and get something out of it and possibly touch them in a way that could alter their thinking, in which I suspect this movie is shooting for. If that's the case, what I think of the movie from my own perspective is irrelevant, so long as it affects the audience that it is intended for.
Yeah.
The movie Joe Bell holds your hand, telling you that you should be kind to others, while some people need to hear that, whether they realize it or not. Sounds cliche, but if the movie lands with one person, stripping them of their fear of other humans, I would absolutely consider this movie a success. All of this is preamble to my question, what are some movies that you're not necessarily a fan of or feel that are kind of basic, although you wouldn't necessarily watch on your own, might perhaps do a good job to enlighten or enrich others' lives and put them on the path to becoming better people? Love you guys, love the show, take care of yourselves, even if it means taking a break from time to time.
Yeah.
If you feel the need to ask permission to do so, I'm giving it to you now.
Thank you.
Signed off. A perfect specimen of human morality that has forsaken film and other forms of art and philosophy because I have nothing more to learn about being good. But you can call me PG for short.
Hi, PG. thank you, PG.
Thank you for writing, PG.
Regarding that last bit, someone mentioned to me on Twitter that other podcasts sometimes take a few weeks off once in a while. And I literally...
Ah, suckers!
No, I literally did a quote to him like, you can do that? And a lot of people said, yeah. You guys make a lot of podcasts, and it's okay if you wanted to take a little time off once in a while to, like, get your bearings and, like, get your shit together. And I'm like, shit. So we might actually do that. We might take a week or two off sometime in the near future just to see what that's like. Because we have been producing multiple podcasts, and in some cases is more than, like, five every single week for the last...
Several years now.
Several years. I mean, we've been making podcasts for over 10, but on that level of production, for the last several years, we've been really cranking them out. And I always feel like we're not doing enough. It always feels like we're behind, because on some level we are. But we also, you know, it is a lot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe a short, you know, detour once in a while to... You know, sleep in for a couple of days and catch up on our rest. And
we tend to
read
record,
a book, perhaps.
We tend to record these late at night, so actually getting to bed at a decent hour would be for a couple of days would be nice.
Yeah.
To address your question, however.
Yes, just please. That's really important.
Yes, absolutely. You and I already mentioned this. We're not big fans of the movie Joker.
Yeah.
We think it's very aesthetically pleasing, but it's a lot of heavy style in service of some pretty flimsy ideas. However, my mom took my nephew, who was 16 or 17 at the time, to go see Joker, and he got it. He understood this sort of way that a system designed to help people with mental illness can fail them and can lead them into being the Joker. It's trying to connect, you know, the failing of a social service to the superhero universe.
And again, I don't think the movie is great, but at least, at the very least, they wanted to use the delivery system of essentially a Batman movie to try to convey something.
Yeah.
And it worked for somebody.
Yeah, my nephew really got it. So I actually... Like, I'm still not a huge fan of that movie, but I have come to sort of appreciate what it's doing a little bit more in sort of communicating to perhaps a teenage audience. Mm. It's an R-rated film, but a teenage audience.
It's clearly intended to be to appeal to younger people. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, so that there is sort of like consequences to the failure of social systems. It's into the sort of like this fictional cartoonish universe at the end.
Yeah.
But it's now connected back to something in the real world. So it actually has like a larger connotation for certain audiences. I don't want to give any leeway to films like Green Book.
No, I think because there's a difference between trying to convey perhaps a naive message and conveying it in a way that is counterproductive, which I think is what Green Book does. And that's not the same thing.
And you and I were recently on Dave White and Alonso Duraldi's podcast talking, or they were on ours. Both of those things are happening. Talking about Christmas movies, and you and Alonso are very interested in what's going on in Hallmark movies.
Yeah.
Because they tend to represent maybe like one of the most regressive attitudes in mainstream entertainment.
Well, sometimes like, regressive, sometimes merely milquetoast conservative.
Right. But, you know, these are movies that are incredibly white. Yes. They're incredibly straight. Mm-hmm. They're all about Christmas, but it's this weird sort of secular American version of Christmas.
Jesus has very little to do with Hallmark Christmas. They're more interested in the trappings of it because that's what Hallmark sells.
It's what Hallmark sells, but, you know, it's also, part of this very particular part of Americana that is kind of lagging way in the back when it comes to progressive attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand wanting to track where the back is, because if the back is moving forward, it means we're all moving forward.
Yeah. We do need people to catch up once in a while,
But at the same time, I'd rather be focusing on sort of, this may be a little bit of a clumsy analogy, but the oxen pulling the cart. Who's up at the front, making sure things are moving forward to begin with? Something like Green Book, I'm not going to give quite as much credit to, even if it is kind of intended for people who think that you can solve racism by becoming friends with somebody of a different race. The important thing is that this one white guy
figured it out, kind of.
We're going to tell the story of this one white guy who was racist and wasn't at the end.
And who also taught the black guy how to be more black. And it's like, because he understood it better, because it's like, no, Green Book. Mm. No, not with you on that. Pass. I'm actually starting to think of like specific examples, but there are definitely a lot of just sort of general movies with good messages that are at the very least harmless, and at best might be a halfway decent delivery system for positivity. That's definitely a thing. I was trying to think if there was something else that it reminded me of. The idea of sort of the message movie in general. I want to give a shout out to a really wonderful quote. I've quoted this before from Glouder Glenns, who did this truly epic. And I think it's a good example of this, actually. They did a truly epic video essay about the Ed Wood film Glenn or Glenda, which was intended by Ed Wood to be an incredibly progressive look at queerness in the, I think it was the 50s, and in particular trans issues, but also, basically all forms of that. And in many respects, you watch the movie, and yeah, it actually is very much ahead of its time in terms of its attitudes. It's also the product of a very pulpy, grindhousey production studio that wanted to add a bunch of random shit that just they thought would sell it.
It also comes at a time when the vocabulary for communicating the trans experience
wasn't
part of the vernacular yet. And it was really, I would say, in a kind of a clumsy but an incredibly earnest way, and an incredibly honest way, try to communicate those things.
Exactly. And Glouder Glenns said something, and they said it so eloquently. I actually screen capped this, and I keep this on my desktop because I think it's so well put. Because it's about messages in movies, when you have a message that is overt. And what they said was, subtlety is seen as a virtue only to those who can afford to be subtle, or by those who wish for a film's message to be so subtle that they can just tune it out. And they continued, quote, keep your politics out of my entertainment, unquote, say the people who benefit the most from complacency. So if you have a message that is important, making it clear and making it something that people can actually digest and understand and actually like take with them, that's not a problem. That's not fundamentally a problem anyway. It's not like in here, like, oh, you have to be subtle about your messaging. That's never actually been a rule.
Yeah.
That's a guideline that was actually promoted in the middle of the 20th century. And this is actually true. By the CIA, because they wanted to get
people... They went into film schools and actually encouraged a certain kind of filmmaking.
This was at the time of, like, the Red Scare in Hollywood, and there was, like, all the McCarthyism and everything like that, and they were worried that Hollywood movies that preached, like, way out their ideas, like, hey, sharing is pretty good, and, hey, maybe, like, businesses that exploit people aren't the good guys, they wanted to tamp down on that, and they didn't want movies to be about overt messaging, because the movies have a lot of power to convince people of things, and that's a power that we only want to reserve to 24-hour cable news stations. Cough.
It's gone way out of control now.
It's gone
now,
way out of control, but that's the point. You look at, like, oh, so you want, like, messaging to be subtle? Then how the fuck is Fox making all that money? Because they're not, that's all they do.
They scream these dumb points over and over again.
So I'm not
going to
complain that a movie is overt in its messaging, especially if the message is kind. That's not so bad, you know? And I haven't seen this Joe Bell movie, but I hope if it's done, if you feel that it is that positive, I hope it's that good. Maybe it is.
And the idea that someone will only be convinced if you help them along gently is also kind of a misnomer as well.
Not necessarily,
I think it's possible to sit a bigot down in front of a Spike Lee movie, and they will hear that because if you're talking about a subtle filmmaker, Spike Lee isn't that.
Never has been.
No, and he's very deliberately isn't that. He's going to make his point with a hammer, and I think being able to outwardly, like, be boldly confrontational about things, about your point, about your politic, about the point you're trying to make, can be just as, if not sometimes more powerful than trying to sort of smooth it into something that's a little bit more palatable.
Yeah. Like, if you try to smooth something into something that's palatable, you run the risk of making it go down easy. You run the risk of making it just like a glass of warm milk or something like that. And it's not going to make an impact.
To go back to Glouder Glenn's quotation there.
You don't want people to tune it out.
Yeah. She pointed out that you're not supposed to be so subtle that you can tune it out.
Yeah.
Try to be subtle to the point that you actually taste it.
Which brings us back to a point we had earlier in this exact episode where we talk about sometimes films aren't about the plot. Sometimes the plot is there, but it's not just about conveying the plot efficiently. Sometimes the message is way more important. And the plot can take a back seat to that for a while if we need to actually discuss something real. And that is not bad storytelling. So, yeah. Anyway, that's a really thoughtful... Thank you for bringing that up. That's a really interesting conversation. I'm glad we're able to have it a bit. And obviously, we're only touching the surface of this. These are big issues that arise in art. And people have been having complicated conversations about them for forever.
You can find plenty of fascinating essays
about these things online.
And as film changes and as audiences change, the topic will continue to evolve.
In any case, thank you everybody for listening. If you want to write in to a future episode of We've Got Mail, it's really easy. Just email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we don't have time to read every email. We're very, very grateful for all the emails that we have. I know Whitney reads them all. It's just we don't have time to cover all of them on the show. Feel free to email us again if you write us something that's very, very important or if it's super duper timely and it's like we have someone's birthday's coming up. We got to get this out there. Send us a tweet. That might help. Just let us put it at the top of the pile. Follow us on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I myself am @WilliamBibiani.
I am @WhitneySeibold.
We also have a P.O. box if anyone wants to send us a snail mail. A few people have. It's very kind of you. Whitney, tell them about their P.O. box.
Right into the our post office box. Just right into the Critically Acclaimed Network. It's P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep. And let's see what we got. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for our Patreon, I know not everyone can afford to, but...
And it's okay. It's okay. Totally. We adore our patrons, but we also don't want to make things bad for people. We know what it's like to be destitute.
At the moment, actually. But seriously, everyone who's contributing to the Patreon is helping keep the show alive. We would not be able to do this show if it wasn't for our patrons. So for those of you who can contribute and have been, please accept our very sincere thank yous. We hope you're enjoying the exclusive shows that we have on our Patreon. Shows like All Our Yesterdays. We're reviewing every single Star Trek ever. We just had a preview episode of that up on this main feed for free. We have Only the Best, where we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We got a new episode of Holy Batman coming out. Also commentary tracks and hangouts and polls to help decide future content. And it's a lot. And we try to make it worth your while. So thank you, everybody, who has signed up and is enjoying the shows. And it means the world to us.
Yeah.
You mean the world to us. We're incredibly grateful for you to be here. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for just going about your life and trying your best every day. That's all anyone can do. So that's it for us. Thank you once again. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.
And me too.
Yeah.